Welcome back to Living Room. I'm Chris Welch. It's been nearly 2 years, can you believe it, since the smoldering battle for control of Pacifica burst into flames here at KPFA, with the firing of our manager, the attempted imposition of a gag rule, the installation of armed guards, and the lockout of the staff. The battle has continued without let-up ever since, in the streets and in the courts, with the dramatic spreading of the flames to New York City with a Christmas coup at our sister station at WBAI, where a new manager was installed in the middle of the night, locks were changed, people were fired, guards appeared, and people were banned. So far, the MO is sounding all too familiar. But there is now an added and very deadly twist, a rewrite of the bylaws by which Pacifica Foundation has ruled itself until now. This rewrite could spell the end of listener-sponsored First Amendment community-based radio. What is to be done? That is our topic on Living Room today. We have Bay Area Attorney Peter Frank in studio to explain the threat of the bylaw changes. But we begin with a report from the front, from New York City. We're joined by phone by two of the people who were fired in the Christmas coup. Bernard White, fired program director at WBAI. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon, Chris.
Very glad you could join us. And on the other line, we have Sharon Harper, fired producer of Wake Up Call, the morning show there, and a union steward. Good afternoon to you, Sharon.
Good afternoon, Chris, and the listeners.
Indeed. So tell us what the scene is and how it's cooking in New York right now. We are very familiar with how it sort of evolved here at KPFA, and of course it was in the summer, and it wasn't in New York, so we had a little better weather situation than you have. How is your support building? What is it looking like?
Well, as I can see it, the support is building, it's growing, and on many fronts. One of the things I've been asked to do is to speak to listener groups in areas outside of New York City, but in the metropolitan, in our listening area. So there are listener groups growing all the time. We have a couple of Long Island Friends chapters, and I went to speak to a group that's growing in New Jersey. There are chapters in Westchester, and also, I understand, a Connecticut chapter of Concerned Friends of WBAI growing. We have people who are small in number, who hold a daily vigil outside the station, and their movements on other levels to take action against the takeover.
And Bernard, how do you feel about the situation? Is it hopeful? Are you inspired by the things that Sharon was talking about, or do you think this is sort of a lost cause already?
Oh, I'm quite hopeful. I think that, first of all, I think that we're going to win this. I think that we're going to get our station back. I think that we're going to, in the long run, remove those renegade board members who are trying to take over the institution. And, when it took place in our community, a lot of our folks were in shock. And I think that shock is ebbing now, and that people are now, they're upset because they realize what has happened. They realize that the programming at the station has changed, that it's not as hard-hitting as it was, that there is a definite move to change the political impact that we're having in our community. So I'm very hopeful. And, like Sharon said, she's been going around to different places outside of the city, and so have I. And, many, many people come by these meetings. It's been really, really good.
Now, Bernard, I saw a piece that you wrote in Black World Today, which was a really wonderful and lengthy chronology of just what's happening. And when you talked about being in shock, that sounded very familiar. And I know that then you recover from that and you start doing things. But one of the things it's sort of familiar about what happened here, but in New York it's taken on a much different twist, is that there are people, we did not have the fact that you have, which is people inside the station siding with Pacifica. And this is, I would imagine, causing very difficult things for you folks to deal with on the outside, to try to explain to the community what's going on. You said that it was clear to listeners that the politics and the air sound had changed. What are you trying to do? Because I know race is one of the things that's being talked about a lot, even though you two folks that were fired were are African-American yourselves. How is this playing out in particular in the African-American community, African-American press?
Well, I think this was part of the strategy, and that was to play the race card, was to try and make it seem that this was actually against the black community against the white community, that people would rally around the support of Utrice Lee, who is a very popular talk show host who was doing our afternoon drive time program. And I think that she believed that she would be able to rally the black community around her and make it a black and white issue.
Yeah.
But, I think it was a miscalculation on her part. Our community is very intelligent, and they're just not falling for it. They recognize, as you said, that the two people who were harmed the most, as far as they can see, were two black folks, and that... we've never had that kind of, there's always the issue of race and always the issue of class, but they've never been prominent at WBAI because we have some really good people there who recognize those issues and have been trying to address them in their programming. But right now, people are not buying that issue that this is a question of race. Some of the people who have been directly under attack have been Amy Goodman, Al Lewis, Mimi Rosenberg with charges of racism. But, our listeners know these people. They've known them for years, long before these other folks came to work at WBAI. So they're going on their past history of knowing these people. Mm-hmm. So they're not buying it.
That's Bernard White, the former program director at WBAI, and Sharan Harper on the other line. Sharan, Bernard says that folks aren't buying it. What is the battle from your point of view? Someone I talked to in New York said that his impression that it was about the gag rule. Out here to us right now, it is totally about these bylaws changes. What is it about to the folks that you're talking to in New York?
Well, there are several things that have people upset. I would say right now that most of the staff on the inside of the station does support Utrice Lead, either by their, outright acceptance of the Pacifica involvement in the day-to-day operation of the station, or by opportunism, the opportunities that she's able to provide for them since she's been there in terms of airtime or being given a program or a promise of a program, or... by fear, because I think that my firing, and I was fired without cause, has had such a chilling effect that the few paid staff members on the inside will not, buck her in terms of anything that might cause them to lose a job. But in terms of the other people who are dissident or resistors or people who would stand up for, I think it would be equal. The bylaws changes, are of extreme concern to those people who resist this move. And by the same token, the issue of free speech is a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be hard to determine which one had more weight in terms of their concerns.
And tell me, what should we do now? What could you use from us? I really also want to hear what it sounds like on the air and what's happening inside from your ability to figure that out.
What we did was we produced 15 hours of programming a week. The Friday program had a different host from Amy and Bernard. It's Mario Murillo, and he still holds his show. And the programming, I think, is pretty much the same as it was before, but we're looking at initially 12 hours of programming that was dedicated to political, economic, social programming that had at its core, the defense of human rights and social justice for people everywhere. We were devoted to preserving those things that are good and just that's now taken up with conversations about, once this week was, I understand last week was Orange Julius and egg creams. Egg greens, you know. So, you know.
We don't talk about egg greens out here on the West Coast. It's sort of a New York thing.
Good for you.
Oh, I like egg greens. I lived in New York.
Yeah. You know, but, I mean, that was, when you consider that the world is going to hell wholesale.
Dig it.
You know, there's strife everywhere. People, you know, are still dying in the streets of New York. People are dying in the streets, you know, in the West Bank. People were dying in the Congo. People were dying from natural causes, from earthquakes in India. And we have nothing more to talk about than egg creams. You know, it's very, you know, then we look at the other types of terrors that people face, economic terrors, you know, not having enough food, not having the right kind of food, people's water being taken, and we're talking about egg cream. So initially we see, you know, an impact, and one of the things that one of our producers, Janice K. Bryant, and I spend time lamenting over is we'll see a story, we'll hear this and we'll hear that. You know, there was a very important community center on the Lower East Side whose recent struggles we've chronicled on the air, and they were involved in a court battle. And we talk about, oh, wow, if we were on the air, we'd be talking about this morning. If we were on the air, we'd be presenting that. So, you know, from the community concern to the international concern, none of that is addressed. You know, people don't have an opportunity to even hear, you know, where we are, what the state of the world is on a given day. With the exception of the short time that he allots for a news broadcast, there's no in-depth discussion of these type of matters.
You're listening to Sharan Harper, the fired producer of Wake Up Call, the morning show at our sister station WBAI in New York. On the other line with us, Bernard White, former program director, and we're going to have to bid farewell to you in order to do justice to the next topic here, which is these bylaw changes. But we're very happy to hear that you seem to be very strong and firm in your determination to not let them get away with this.
I think we're going to win. I think that the, and it's up to the listeners who have been listening and supporting this radio station for many years. I think they're going to organize themselves to make sure that we win this one.
Indeed, it is up to the listeners. It's all been up to the listeners. It is about the listeners. That's to me. Thank you very much, both of you,
Thank you so much
for calling to talking to us. Here in studio, Peter Frank, member of the steering committee, attorney at law. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
So these bylaw changes that have been written by John Murdoch and will be voted on, as I understand it, at the national board meeting in March. What would they do?
Well, I think that their true purpose is to move Pacifica out of California. They reek of that. Now they look at them very carefully. They're very vague when they talk about the law that they're going to operate under. They have some provisions that are in violation of California law. As would be a smart and clever thing for them to do. They would probably, they must want to get out from under the California courts, the threat of successful court action here, out from under the authority of the California Attorney General. I am quite convinced that what these bylaws fundamentally do and what their purpose is to make it possible, well, it's already possible, to make it easier for them to move Pacifica entirely out of California. That doesn't mean that KPFA would physically move, but that the corporation would move. They'd move it to a state like Delaware with lax laws. These bylaws allow them to operate in secret. One of the most devastating clauses is the amendment clause. You know, a lot of people are sending in a lot of comments, and I think that's mostly a waste of time. I think the only comment is don't do it, because the amendment clause is astonishing. I've never seen one in any bylaws, corporate or non-profit, that says the board can change anything in the bylaws at any meeting without notice by a bare majority. That means at any time, as little as six directors could change the entire document. So it doesn't that much matter if some of our sympathetic board members get bring a few concessions out of them at this meeting. That's really going to be a waste of time.
So you're talking about the difference between concessions and editing this document and just rejecting it a whole cloth.
It must be defeated whole cloth. It does a lot of other horrible things. The minute it's passed, they would have the power to add about a third of the membership to the station advisory boards. They could add five or ten of their cronies to the KPFA board instantly. they could actually eliminate the whole KPFA board and replace it with another board.
You mean the board that we just went through in a whole election to arrive at?
The board that we just elected.
Mm-hmm.
Strikingly, it explicitly gives the executive director of the foundation authority deep into the stations. Now the executive director oversees the managers, and the managers have the ultimate higher firepower. This bylaw explicitly says that the executive director can have higher and higher power over the receptionist, over the board op, over Chris Welch. There's a loyalty oath built into these bylaws. There was a notorious memorandum from an earlier executive director called My Way or the Highway, which said to the boards that if you don't support everything, that your job is to support Pacifica to the community. Now, that's a direct violation of the Public Broadcasting Act, which requires local boards to be a conduit of opinion and feedback up from the community to the governing board. This basically says that to be on either of these boards, the national board or the station board, you've got to be totally loyal and agree with everything.
Yeah, your job is to sell the executive director's and the national board's plan to these poor schmoes who are listening.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It allows secret meetings. It allows complete delegation of power to the small executive committee or to other committees. It allows them to meet in secret. It says only to they have to give notice of meetings only to the extent required by law. It allows them to call a full meeting of the Pacifica Board on 24 hours notice. It allows them to have entire meetings on the phone, which means that they can't possibly be public meetings. So it puts every director in the position that, you know, he could get a call at 8 o'clock Friday night while he's out gone for the weekend, and there could be a meeting at 8 o'clock Saturday night on the phone, and that meeting would have the full power of the foundation. I mean, it's a horror story, and it's a mistake to go in much more into detail. I could.
Well, the thing that we've been talking about a lot on the air, and the thing that I think is going to resound, and certainly resound with us, is that there is this increased feasibility of a sale of one of the stations in these bylaws.
Yeah, I think these bylaws allow the executive committee, not the full board, just the executive committee, which is five or seven people, and that's the loyalist, to sell. They could actually sell four of the five stations just on their own authority without even going to the board. And it certainly
seems... Yes, the only thing it says is that they can't sell all.
Right.
Doesn't say they can't sell everything but...
That's right. So if they sold all five licenses and just kept the building that we're sitting in, that's not selling all. And only selling totally everything requires a full board, and that's only in there because the law requires it. Now, these bylaws are greasing the skids. And I think very, very importantly, they are an attempt to get out from under the lawsuits. The lawsuits are probably our only hope right at this point to really say things. We need the support of the Attorney General, which we have, and the courts. You set a new corporation up called the Mary Frances Berry Foundation in Delaware. You get the FCC, which now is run by Colin Powell's son Michael, to transfer the licenses. That wouldn't be a forum where we could stop it. And Pacific itself is just a shell. And so you win the lawsuits, and what do you have? I think that's a lot of what this is about. So the lawsuits need to be supported. I make a plug. People, there is a question. Everybody says, what can I do? One of the most important things to do is to send a contribution. I'd say send the 20% of your contribution that would go to the station to the legal fund, because Pacifica is taking about 20% off the top.
Well, that's easy for you to say, because you are not on the payroll here at the radio station. So, and, of course, if those of us who are on the payroll here don't get paid, we won't be here.
No, you should be paid. And so people should add 20% to their plan. and they should send it to the Free Pacifica Legal Action Fund at the Vanguard Foundation, Free Pacifica Legal Fund at the Vanguard Foundation, 383 Rhode Island Street, San Francisco, 94103. And that money gets split between the three lawsuits, and they all need
cool.
It.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
So what did the Vanguard say it again?
It's the Free Pacifica Legal Action Fund at
Free
Vanguard.
Free Pacifica
Legal Action slash Vanguard. That's
okay.
The way the check should be. 383 The mailing address is 383 Rhode Island Street, Suite 301, San Francisco 94103.
And this information is at the front desk, too, with our receptionist, if you call the station, mm-hmm. Anita. And it's also doubtless on the Save Pacifica website, which is www.savepacifica.org.
Right. And the board, our sympathetic board members are taking comments to the board. Frankly, they should be flooded with emails, faxes, telegrams, whatever, saying, don't do it. And if people want to contrast it, on the webpage of the committee to remove the board, there is a set of new bylaws, which are very democratic. What this board should really do is adopt those bylaws. Those are the kind of bylaws that we ultimately need, which will make Pacifica a democratic organization with the station boards elected and the Pacifica board elected by the station boards.
Peter Frank is our guest in studio, and we are out of time for this discussion today, but obviously we're going to have it again. And I said org, and it's net. So it's www.savepacifica.net for further information. We will be giving you further information at this program. But right now, I want to bring you the voice of one of the folks who is still working at WBAI, but who is not a sellout. And in fact, she is under such incredible pressure and attack that I don't know how she continues. Her name is Amy Goodman, and she is the host of Democracy Now!, which is on from 9 to 10 on these airwaves. And we're going to bring you a little piece of an address she made. She visited California in November, and we're going to play you a little bit of that just to give you a flavor, as if you haven't had it already, of what exactly is at stake here. Here's Amy Goodman.
I thought I'd start off by reading an excerpt from Ken Sarawiwa's last speech before the military tribunal of Nigeria that tried him. Tried him for his crime of coming back to his people in Ogoni land. You know, Ken Sarawiwa was the leading playwright of Nigeria, known for writing the most popular soap opera in Nigeria, and was head of the Nigerian Writers Association. But with all of his success, he said he could not ignore the plight of his people, 500,000 Ogoni who live in Ogoni land and the Niger Delta, who were fighting the battle of their lives, of their entire population, their culture, their land, against a large multinational corporation, Shell. He took that struggle, and perhaps this was his greatest crime, international, and he let people all over the world know what it meant to fill their tanks with Shell. And as he stood before the military tribunal, before they sentenced him and eight other activists to death, he said, "My Lord, we all stand before history. I am a man of peace, of ideas, appalled by the denigrating poverty of my people who live on a richly endowed land, distressed by their political marginalization and economic strangulation, angered by the devastation of their land, their ultimate heritage, anxious to preserve their right to life and to a decent living, and determined to usher to this country as a whole a fair and just democratic system which protects everyone and every ethnic group, and gives us all a valid claim to human civilization. I have devoted my intellectual and material resources, my very life, to a cause in which I have total belief and from which I cannot be blackmailed or intimidated. I have no doubt at all about the ultimate success of my cause. No matter the trials and tribulations which I and those who believe with me may encounter on our journey, nor imprisonment nor death can stop our ultimate victory. I repeat that we all stand before history. I and my colleagues are not the only ones on trial. Shell is here on trial." He goes on to speak about Nigeria, about his people, the Ogoni, about Shell. He says, "The military does not act alone. They're supported by a gaggle of politicians, lawyers, judges, academics, and businessmen." And he ends by saying, "In my innocence of the false charges I face here, in my utter conviction, I call upon the Ogoni people, the peoples of the Niger Delta, and the oppressed ethnic minorities of Nigeria to stand up now and fight fearlessly and peacefully for their rights. History is on their side. God is on their side. This definitely brings back memories for me, because in 1994, just before Ken Saro-Wiwa went back to Nigeria and was imprisoned, he came to the United States. And we at WBAI, the Pacifica station in New York where I work, were one of the few people to interview him. I actually hadn't even heard about him at the time. And this man walked in, and I said, oh, I don't even know if we're going to be able to have time. We hadn't booked him for the show. And we said, okay, we'll give him a couple minutes. He's come from Nigeria after all. And then as he spoke, we bumped the rest of the show. I mean, I really did not know anything about him before he came into the studio. But this was a great man. You could sense it immediately as he talked about the plight of his people. It also shows how great Pacifica is, because the people who brought him to the United States knew that it was WBAI that would hear him out, that would provide a microphone. And he was almost interviewed by no one else in this country. A man who was taking on the power of the state, the power of the corporations, the power of the United States supporting the Nigerian dictatorship. Here he was, one man representing 500,000 people. And he said in that interview, I am a marked man if I go back. He went back, was arrested, tried, and on November 10, 1995, he was executed. 3 years later, I got a chance to go to Nigeria. There was a moment when Abacha, the military dictator who had killed Ken Saro-Wiwa, died. And there was a moment, a small opening, when we thought we could get a visa. I went there with another reporter, Jeremy Scahill. Regular KPFK listeners know what an incredible job Jeremy's been doing from Yugoslavia, where he has moved. But Jeremy and I went to Nigeria in the summer of 1998. And the high point of this trip is we were investigating, well, your oil company in Nigeria, another one, the largest corporation headquartered in California, Chevron. We went to Ogoni Land, and we went to Ken's house, and we met his parents, who were still grieving. And as we stood there, hundreds of people came to Ken's house to sing to us the Ogoni anthem. And one man stood up, and he read Ken's last speech from heart by heart. And we included that in our documentary, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. What we discovered was another company, Chevron, doing similar things as Shell, which had for a time been driven out of Ogoni Land. We found what Chevron was doing in an area called Elijah Land, where on May 28, 1998, when once again, and this happens all the time in the Niger Delta, villagers were protesting the environmental devastation that occurs because of these oil companies that drill the power from to provide power to the most powerful countries in the world, and yet increasingly disempower these host communities of where they get the oil from. They were drilling another oil spill. The people went to the barge and they said, we want to negotiate with the highest level representative. We want to negotiate with the American that represents Chevron here. They wanted to negotiate with George Kirkland, who is the head of Chevron Nigeria Limited, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Chevron based up in San Francisco. They refused Chevron, but they did send a person to negotiate with them. And after a few days, when the people on the barge who had occupied the barge were getting word from their elders who were doing the negotiations on land that they thought that the negotiations would be concluding, they started to pack up. And on that last morning, on May 28, 1998, they saw Chevron helicopters flying in, and they figured that they would be bringing in the Nigerian, that they would be bringing in the final negotiators. Instead of the final negotiators being brought in, Chevron Corporation brought in the Nigerian military and the mobile police known as the Kill and Go. That's the Kill and Go. And they opened fire on the protesters, and they executed two of them. critically wounded a third. They had a bunch of other protesters rounded up, brought off to the notorious Nigerian jails. And that was just another day in the Niger Delta. The corporate media in this country hardly cover those kinds of stories. When they do cover stories in the Niger Delta, it's usually about a gas pipeline that blows up. You read about it, and they say things like AP says this, the New York Times says this, and it comes from the press releases of the corporations that own these pipelines. They say things like vandals and thieves once again drilled a hole in a pipeline, and that's what caused it to burst. They never arrested one of these, quote, vandals or thieves. AP and the New York Times had a piece where it said, this was just last year, the proof that they were vandals and thieves was that they're carrying little containers. These are kids who come with broken cups and anything that they can carry to these leaky pipelines that the communities have begged the companies to fix for decades. And the kids will come and they'll try to collect it in any way they can because they don't get the oil or gas themselves. They have nothing in the Niger Delta. So they come and they try to take advantage of this. They say the vandals and thieves, mainly children, their charred bodies were found still cupping those containers, which showed that they were thieves. It's an incredible story, what goes on there, especially as we read about the oil crisis here. And we think about just the price of the oil that goes into our tanks, when that's really the price of the oil in Nigeria. And that's why it's so important to have an independent press. Jeremy and I found a quote of George Kirkland, the head of Nigeria, Chevron Nigeria Limited, in Nigeria's Oil and Gas, which is a magazine that comes out monthly. He said, "We're more likely to see other companies as collaborators rather than adversaries. We aren't so much competing with each other as we are competing with the earth." And maybe that's a healthy way to look at it, he says. "We aren't so much competing with each other as we are competing with the earth." And that's maybe a healthy way to look at it. And that's precisely what these people were protesting. And it's also what people around the world now are rising up against. And that's where all the hope is right now. Democracy Now! Went out in force to Seattle, November of 1999. We didn't go out with the rest of the press after, you know, it appeared that it was going to be a very big story. But we took the whole team and more out because these were the voices that we had been broadcasting for years. We've almost been on now for 5 years. We began as the only daily election show in public broadcasting in February of 1996. And we realized that this event was going to be big, that this was a true global uprising against corporate power, and that it had to be covered by independent media. You know, probably most of you, the history of Pacifica, which is a very proud and long history that we all must fight to preserve. In 1949, Lew Hill, a pacifist who'd been in prison during World War II, came out of prison and said there had to be a media outlet that was not run by corporations that were building a drumbeat to a third world war, because war is profitable for corporations, but there had to be a media outlet that was run by journalists and artists. Journalists and artists who didn't have that same agenda, the same agenda of corporations, who is George Gerbner, the founder of the Cultural Environ Movement, says, "Corporations with nothing to tell and everything to sell. The corporations that are raising our children, they're spending more time watching television and being raised by these companies than they are in the company of their parents and their families and their communities." And that's how Pacifica was born, a remarkable experiment in 1949. And then the other stations came on board, KPFK here, 90.7 FM in Texas, KPFT, which was, its transmitter was blown up twice in the first year of operation in 1970 by the Ku Klux Klan, And when the exalted Cyclops went on trial for those acts, he said it was his proudest moment, his proudest act, because he knew what Pacifico was about. It was about opening microphones to the most disempowered, marginalized people to fight bigotry. Because once you hear people speaking, it's much harder to hate. It's just inevitable that you will find yourself identifying. And that's the idea of Pacifica, is to increase understanding and communication. WPFW went on the air in Washington in 1977, and WBAI, the place where I work in New York, went on air January of 1960. It is now 40 years old. That was owned by a man named Lou Schweitzer, a philanthropist, broadcasting from the roof of the Hotel Pierre. I can't think of a more strange contrast to what we are today. But when the newspapers were struck, the Herald Tribune and others, all the advertisers raced to radio, and he realized how advertisement-driven the media was. And he, too, understood there had to be something that was independent. And so he called the Pacifica Foundation in Berkeley, and he said, I give you this station. And that's how we went on the air. And so we have something very important to preserve as we move into the next millennium. The only independent media network in this country. It is so important. I realized the importance of it just a few days ago when President Clinton called. It was on Election Day. It was about 10 minutes to 9 when all mortals know they do not call they don't call into the Democracy Now! Office if they want to live beyond the show. And so when the phone rang, I thought, well, this must be important. So I picked up the phone, and someone said, this is White Horse Communications. And there is a bar in New York called the White Horse. And I said, what? And they said, White House Communications, the president would like to come on the radio. And I said, the president of what? And the woman said, the president of the United States. I said, right. I figured this was a new one to get the internal line to master control. But she was persistent and said he was making calls to talk about getting the vote out. And I said, okay, I just had to get off the phone. So I gave the internal line to master control. And we went on with the show. And as our completely crazed producers were trying to get us online, I said to Maria, who has come back from Spain to produce for a month now, Maria Carrion, an absolutely wonderful woman, producer, reporter, who has been very involved, particularly in death penalty cases. Maria, as she was getting everything ready for us to go on, I said, oh, Maria, just one last thing. If the president calls, if you have any questions or anything, just let me know what you would think. Just let me know what you would want to ask him. And she turned to me, and she said, just turn on the mic and get on the air. Do you know what I was talking about? We did the show. He didn't call, and it confirmed my suspicions that it probably was White Horse Communications. And then when we got off the air at about 11 o'clock, we got a call in Master Control. It was the Latino music show, La Nueva Alternativa. And I went in, and they said, this is the White House, the president's on the line. Gonzalo Alberto, who is the host of that program, we hooked him in. They said it would be a minute because he was getting a call from the vice president. And then I sat down, and then all of a sudden we heard under the music, it was some Latino rap music, we heard President Clinton saying an inimitable Pacifica opening to conversations. Hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And Gonzalo is having trouble. He was a little befuddled, and he was forgetting to bring down the CD. So there you hear in the background, can you hear me? At which point I leaped over the master control board, bruising my hip, throwing down the music, putting on all the microphones, and got ready to do the interview that we had not planned for, less than 5 seconds worth. They said again that he wanted to talk about voter turnout. So I said, Mr. President, are you there? Which is actually a deep question, but he just said, I am. Can you hear me? And I said, yes, we can. You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations? And that they are, that they feel at this point that their vote doesn't make a difference. Now, I had just caught my breath as I climbed back over the master control. And he said, well, there's just not a shred of evidence to support that. Now, these questions are not that big a deal. It's what's on a lot of people's minds in this country, talking about corporate control, talking about racism and public policy, talking about foreign policy. But we don't have an independent media base in this country where you're going to get these questions asked on any regular basis. And you see the kind of pressures we're under, because the next day, I got a call from Newsday. They wanted to follow up on the interview, and as I was talking to them, the White House called on the other line. This time I knew it wasn't that far, that it was the White House. And I put the phone down with Newsday, and I went to the other line, and it ended up he heard this whole conversation, the Newsday reporter, as it got extremely heated. And it was the head of White House Communications, and she said that they would withhold all further cooperation with WBAI and our network, given that I had broken the ground rules. And I said, and what exactly were the ground rules? Should I told you he had 2 or 3 minutes? And so she said, we had agreed on that. I said, first of all, you gave me about a second. You said, the president is on the phone, he has a couple minutes, and of course I would push it, and he could have hung up at any point. And she said, no, he could not have. I said, the man is the leader of the Western world. He could have hung up the phone if he wanted to. And she said, not only did you spend his time, he had other important things to do. And I was just thinking of maybe actually in that 30-minute period, which I think was the longest phone interview he'd ever conducted, we saved some lives. Maybe. By distracting him, he didn't bomb Afghanistan again, or the Sudan, or Iraq, which we are doing on a regular basis every week. Maybe for that just 30-minute time, there was still time, there was some peace in the world. I don't know. But he said, she said that there were two things I had violated. One was I'd gone beyond the two to three minutes. And the other, and then I said, but he didn't even ask to get off until around 24 minutes in. He said, this will be the last question. And then I just asked one other question. She said, you asked two other questions. But the other thing that particularly aggravated them, which was why they were blacklisting me from the White House, was that she had made it very clear to me, as she had to the other reporters, but those reporters had followed the rules. He had talked to about 40 radio stations on Tuesday, that he wanted to talk about voter turnout. She said, now, your first question related to that issue. And then she said, and something like the fifth question, the seventh question had some resonance with that issue. But the rest of the questions were far afield, and that's not what we had agreed upon. And I said, I might come as a surprise, but I am a reporter, and you did not fax over the questions, but of course we wouldn't have followed them, and it is not my problem if the rest of the media agreed to those ground rules. But